Senate Republican efforts to replace big parts of the Affordable Care Act and enact steep Medicaid spending cuts collapsed yesterday. What now? It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour, Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. Also on our docket, the Supreme Court breathes new life into Trump's travel ban. A new survey of 37 countries shows faith in American leadership has plunged in many nations around the world in the months since President Trump took office. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Rachel Caulfield, also of Drake University, joins us this hour in our studio, associate professor of political science at Drake in Des Moines. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
We're going to have our listeners join us this hour, as we love to always on Politics Wednesday especially. And today, front and center, your thoughts and questions on the way forward now that the Senate GOP effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act has floundered, or has it foundered? We don't know. We'll see in the few coming weeks. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the hour, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, on Monday, breathing some new life into Trump's travel ban. We'll see how much of a victory for the president that is. Also, an interesting survey I want to ask Dennis, you and Rachel about. 37 countries polled by Pew Research showing that faith in American leadership worldwide has plunged in many of these countries since the President Trump took office. There is one exception, one country where it hasn't plunged, where it's actually increased. I'll let you think that over, and we'll get to that a little bit later. Rachel, I think you have an idea based on.
I do.
Let's talk first of all about the health care effort. The Senate Republican effort to pass a measure replacing big parts of the Affordable Care Act and enact some steep Medicaid spending cuts collapsed yesterday. Senators, I guess, just kept jumping ship. And this forced the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, to suspend his plans for a vote yet this week. It was on Monday, and this was a decisive blow, I guess, the Congressional Budget Office finding that in its scoring that if the bill were enacted, 22 million fewer people would have health insurance over the next decade, due in part to the bill's rollback of Medicaid expansion. Let's listen to the majority leader explain the delay in the vote.
Legislation of this complexity almost always takes longer than anybody else would hope. But we're going to press on. We think the status quo is unsustainable for all the obvious reasons we've discussed over and over and over again. And we're optimistic we're going to get to a result that's better than the status quo.
Okay, Mitch McConnell, optimistic. Dennis, tell us, was this first step, at least, we don't know how the story will end, a miscalculation by Mitch?
Well, it certainly seems to be. I wouldn't count him out yet, despite all the breathless coverage of cable TV and the attempt to pronounce this dead, because it would involve, to some extent, I think, pulling a rabbit out of a hat, but if anybody can do that, it's Mitch McConnell. As most people have noticed, he's essentially trying to square the circle, because he's got the it's too much almost to say moderates in the Republican Party, but you have the more centrist conservatives like Susan Collins and Senator Murkowski from Alaska and a few others who are concerned about the possibility of losing the Medicaid benefits from the expansion that works well in their states. But on the other end, you've got the hardline conservatives like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and others, who believe this is simply Obamacare light, and they believe this does not go far enough toward repeal. And what you have is Leader McConnell trying to pull those two together when, at the moment at least, anything he does for one drives the others away.
Hmm. According to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, Americans broadly disapproving of this Senate health care bill, unhappy with how Republicans as well are handling the efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. According to this poll, just 17% of those surveyed say they approve of this plan. It's called the Better Care Reconciliation Act.
It's a great name, isn't it?
You have to have a name. 55% say they disapprove, while about a quarter say they hadn't heard enough about the proposal to have an opinion on it. I guess with this kind of lack of support in this poll, this nonpartisan poll, Rachel, we have representatives, not representatives, but senators in this case, with some kind of feeling of the pulse back home in their home states. With that lack of support, is it any wonder that the senators are nervous about this?
No, it's not. And I think, you know, congressional leaders and Republicans in general have seen this as, we've promised this for 7 years. We have a mandate now. We control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. It's time to get this done. One of the problems, however, is that in pushing it through quickly, right, because they didn't spend those 7 years coming up with a concrete policy proposal. So now they're in the weeds trying to negotiate the details, which they haven't really talked about on the campaign trail. You know, even after the 2016 election cycle, about 35% of Americans still don't know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing. So this mandate that they have, or that they perceive, to repeal and replace Obamacare, you know, when you start actually talking about what that means, then people start to get really nervous. And there's a reason we've seen support for the ACA increase since this effort to repeal and replace has begun.
Mm-hmm. I'd add the point, though, and Rachel certainly knows this. When you talk about that national poll, none of these senators is electorally accountable to the nation at large.
Absolutely.
So the question is whether the fact that the this poll say nationally, here's where the people of America are, the central question for these senators is, where are the people of their particular state?
Right.
It's to that they'll be most responsive.
Right. In our state, it means Senators Ernst and Grassley. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden just received this note from Senator Grassley's press secretary. There isn't a final bill yet. Senator Grassley won't make a decision on how to vote until the final text is available and can be read and studied. That being said, Grassley has consistently said this may be Republicans, congressional Republicans' only chance to pass a bill to repeal Obamacare. Now, to my knowledge, Senator Ernst has not come down one way or another on this bill, as have a large number of U.S. senators there. So, Dennis, you're saying, you know, they're weighing. Does it really matter the calls to the office, the number of calls, whether the calls are in favor or against it?
These aren't representative samples overall. It's just who has the time to speak the loudest. So I tend to think that to a great extent, not entirely, but to a great extent, these offices will hear what they want to hear from these particular calls.
Mm-hmm.
I think more significant is if it's accurate, the report from a day or two ago, that passing this particular bill would severely hurt a lot of rural hospitals here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything, it's a Republican constituency here in Iowa. It's the rural areas. So, yeah, as Rachel very correctly pointed out, you know, the Republican mantra for all these years has been, you know, repeal this act that was spawned in the hellfires of Satan, as far as they're concerned. and they're going to look awfully foolish if, in fact, their bluff is called and say, all right, you guys got to repeal it. And their big concern at the actual beginning was that once people got used to it, at least many of those people, obviously not all of them, It's a lot easier to oppose giving someone a particular benefit at the beginning than it is at the end to try to take away a benefit that started to kick in for people and actually had a change in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Add to that another facet here. The governors in the U.S. Against this change, also Republican governors. The majority of governors in the United States are Republicans. Let's listen to this. Yesterday, Governors John Kasich, the Republican from Ohio, former presidential candidate, and also John Hickenlooper, Democrat from Colorado, spoke to reporters at the National Press Club about this Senate proposal. They both mentioned they were alarmed at the potential for harm to their constituents, the state budgets, the insurance markets. Kasich called the plan unacceptable, inadequate. He emphasized the need for bipartisan reform. Let's listen.
What's happened to Republicans is for 7 years they've run around bashing Obamacare, and they're the dog that caught the car. Now they don't know what to do. And got 22, 23 million Americans who lose health insurance, and they think that's great? That's good public policy? What, are you kidding me? Thank God. I mean, why don't we have those folks go and live under a health care, under Medicaid for a while? Why don't we have them go live under exchange where they can get $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a year to cover their health insurance costs? I mean, all this rhetoric. You know, I had a Democrat call me yesterday, says, you know, should we kill the bill? I said, language matters. Don't put stuff in people's face. You don't have to talk about are we killing or are we replacing. Just get it done. Sit in a room and figure out how we can bring the needed changes, because there is nobody that I know, no responsible public official or health advocate, who doesn't think we need changes to this.
Okay, I repeat, Republican Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Rachel, what do you think of his comment?
Well, I mean, I think this is what we're seeing. And to Dennis's earlier point, you know, so many different dynamics are coming into play here, right? You have the Senate trying to craft national policy, but of course, governors are on the ground in their state with needs and concerns that are peculiar to their states. And I think they're frustrated. They're seeing destabilization of the healthcare market taking place in a variety of states around the country. Some states are more dependent on that Medicaid expansion than other states are. Some states have older populations where we know that you're likely to get high premiums, significantly higher premiums under the Senate bill than under the existing plans. So, you know, you're negotiating local conditions within this broader national debate. And so I don't think it's a surprise that we have a lot of governors coming out and expressing concern. You also have, as part of the Senate bill, a significant cutback on national spending for Medicaid, leaving the states to pick up a good deal of Medicaid spending. And if you're a governor right now and you're trying to balance a state budget, that's incredibly daunting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds saying what we have now isn't an option in Iowa, that the current health insurance market is collapsing.
We've seen premiums increase 110% over the last 5 years, and because of the high cost of premiums, we're seeing healthy and young people step out of the individual market, and because of that, it's collapsed, and our carriers are leaving because they can't, it's not sustainable. So we need to stabilize the individual market.
And to that end, Governor Reynolds says they're working on a stopgap measure so that over 70,000 Iowans have some access to individual health insurance in January of 2018. She mentioned that there still needs to be federal government to implement long-term health care. So what about that long-term part, Dennis? I mean, how does the GOP, from this point on, deal with one of the basic ideas behind both the House and the Senate plans, namely to cut Medicaid for the neediest Americans in order to cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans? I mean, I don't know if is there any debate about the characterization I just put out there? It seems like, according to these polls, Americans are drawing that out of this.
I think that's accurate. I think that you have a situation in which when you have these claims constantly that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is collapsing, I think it's legitimate to say that Republicans have done everything they can to undermine that and then criticize it for collapsing. I'm not an expert in health policy, so I make that disclaimer. But I think that a lot of the problem with the insurance companies is the lack of certainty caused by the question of what the federal government could do. And if the federal government made a decision to continue the subsidies, then that market would settle down. But I think that additionally, one of the reasons that supposedly premiums would when they talk about the tremendous increase in the cost of premiums, as what we just the comment we just heard, you don't hear the other side of that coin. At least under Obamacare, there are subsidies to help bite into that increase, and in many cases, people are no worse off than they were. Yeah, the premium went up, but the subsidy went up as well, so there's no or very little more out of pocket. Now, in any individual case, that could change. But overall, when according to the Republican plan, if they say that the premiums will be cheaper, there are two reasons. Number one, premiums are always cheaper for younger people, because they tend to have, on average, fewer health problems than people 65 and older. And number two, you know, if you want to sell me a house, I can buy that house a lot more cheaply if there's no heating and cooling system in it. In other words, so many of these new plans, at least as far as what I've read is concerned, is indicated, they cover so much less. Certain kinds of basic surgeries, certain women's kinds of issues, their mandated coverage now under Obamacare, they wouldn't be mandated under the new plan. So, of course, they're going to be cheaper, but you're buying insurance that's going to be cheaper, yes, but it's going to do a heck of a lot less for you than you thought it would do.
Mm-hmm. How does the situation change now that the delay in the vote has been announced by the Senate Majority Leader? What changes between now and after the 4th of July break? I mean, you can see it, Rachel, it gives more time for the opposition to mount. It gives more time for some wheeling and dealing, but also for constituents to voice their concerns, at least if they line up with the polls that I was mentioning here, that they will be against it.
Yeah, absolutely. And both of those things are true. It'll give more time for the opposition to organize. It'll give more time for some backroom conversations to happen to try to figure out if there's a way to bring together the most conservative and the moderates within the party. I think, you know, procedurally, the Senate is really depending on working through this reconciliation process so that they can do this with a simple majority. And, you know, I think Mitch McConnell's comments to his conference, where he said, look, you know, we're either going to have to find a way to reach agreement on this, or we're going to have to go to Chuck Schumer and start talking to the Democrats, right?
Right.
That's the worst thing that can possibly happen right now if you're a Republican.
Right,
is to say,
that,
oh my gosh.
That's like taking your sketch, what is the toy I'm thinking of? From
your Etch-a-Sketch?
Your Etch-a-Sketch
yes.
is shaking it real hard, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Rachel, for back to childhood with me.
Though. There you go. So, I mean, I anticipate that they're going to be rewriting the bill. I anticipate that there will be an effort to get a new CBO score. And to try to reevaluate what this plan can look like. Remember that when the House bill went through, there were a lot of questions about, you know, is this the right thing to do and should we push it through as quickly as we're pushing it through? Everybody's response seemed to be, well, the Senate will fix the problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which means there's a lot at stake for the Senate right now. Any bill that the Senate passes, we're still not in a final form. This is, you know, we're still in the very early stages of this process.
Mm-hmm.
So we have no idea what the final product might ultimately look like.
Join our conversation. Want to get a couple of quick calls in before we go to a break on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River with Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Des Moines. James is in Des Moines. What do you make of the latest development here with the Senate plan on health care?
Well, I don't think that, first off, I think their criticism of Obamacare is misplaced, because everything that was wrong with Obamacare was inserted to try to get Republican votes. The second thing is I think it was Steve Goldford was right on. They've done everything they could to make Obamacare fail. We lost a very viable going concern with the startup, more like a consortium than a in a not-for-profit than a for-profit company just because they wouldn't give the supplemental subsidy to carry them through while they were paying claims in a timely manner, which it seems in Iowa is no longer an attractive or a goal to reach, to pay your claims in a timely manner, simply because Congress failed to put money in the subsidy pot. So for them to criticize Obama for being in the mess, they're the ones who have created the mess. And almost everything that's wrong with Obamacare is put in there because they were trying to get Republican votes. So,
James, we got it in Des Moines. We're coming up on a break. Thank you, James, in Des Moines. Let's go to Steve in Mason City. Hi, Steve. Do you have a different shade of what's being said here?
I do. It's exasperating through all the months. The debate about, quote, health care really isn't about care. It's about financing. And I think, you know, everybody would agree or, you know, statistics say that we spend too much and we don't get the results that we would want. And you don't fix that by talking about who's going to pay how much. You know, the anti-market or market deficiencies for health care need to be addressed. It's as if you were limited to going to only one of your local car dealerships, but you really didn't have much information about the various models, and you had no information about the quality of the repair staff. Mm-hmm. And the prices for everything are generally unknown. You can't have a marketplace with all of those features, and that's just some of them.
Okay. Steve, thanks for your thoughts from Mason City. We're coming up on a break here. I wonder, I heard Elizabeth Warren, certainly someone who's being thought of as a 2020 presidential contender, mentioning single payer, universal health care, single payer, as a venue. I wonder, Dennis, if you think if you could see down the road, if we see this challenge not being met by the Republicans when they have control of the House and the Senate and control of the White House, if actually it may in a strange way veer towards a single payer system.
There's been some comment, fairly not widely yet, but some comment that given the difficulties with Obamacare, which supposedly some are fixable, supposedly some aren't, but there are difficulties to be sure. That if the Republicans aren't able to substitute their preference at this point, that it's going to have a trajectory that's going to lead, according to this commentary, inevitably towards single payer. Mm. But I'll just say real quickly, as I've said before on the program, broadly there's a philosophical difference. Republicans still seem to think that health care, or at least health insurance, is a commodity that a person can choose to buy or not buy, like buying a car, whereas Democrats tend to think of health care as a right of citizenship, and that's what leads so many of them to the idea of single payer.
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back and deal with some other things on the political landscape with Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Rachel Caulfield of Drake. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we talk about the Supreme Court's decision earlier this week, breathing some new life into Trump's travel ban. Also, this new survey of 37 countries showing that faith in American leadership worldwide has plunged since President Trump took office. We'll talk about that. Also, a top Democrat in the House Intelligence Committee says that the Obama administration should have taken bolder action in response to intelligence reports about Russian meddling in our election. We'll talk about it when we get back with Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford. And hopefully you'll be around as well. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, a conversation with Brooke Gladstone. I'll talk with Brooke Gladstone, the Peabody Award-winning journalist, co-host and managing editor of Public Radio's On the Media. She has a new book out. It's called The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. It's a very interesting, compact book talking about fake news, alternative facts, and lies disguised as truths, as she puts it, all overwhelming our notions of reality. Tomorrow on the program, Brooke Gladstone of Public Radio's On the Media. Today, we have Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us on our Politics Wednesday edition, talking in the first half hour primarily about health care developments this week with the collapse, at least for the meantime, of the Senate Republican plan to get enough votes to their effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Before we move on to a couple of other things we do want to get to this hour, let's go to Nick, who wants to chip in something about that. Nick in Des Moines, hi, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call very much. And I guess a couple of things that I just come to mind is I look at single payer as being a death sentence for whenever we look at our healthcare system, because it's treating a symptom and not the actual disease. And that's because when we look at the VA and other government-run programs, we all complain about them, and yet we want something as complex as healthcare managed by our government. And it's kind of interesting that Des Moines would absolutely be devastated from an insurance perspective whenever we look at it. And mm-hmm. similarly, kind of jumping into that point, whenever we talk about treating the disease, the insurance companies are covering what they're forced to. And so you look at that, the hospital is charging a certain fee. I mean, a bag of saline can cost up to $900. And so whenever you get money, that doesn't matter to the individual because insurance just has the ability to cover it. And again, I'm not saying that there isn't fault within Obamacare and the current healthcare system, but I think we need to look at that. Obamacare is quickly bankrupting a state that everyone points to as Maine, where it requires a $15 billion a year subsidy. If you multiply that by 50 states, it's impossible to quantify $450 billion a year to maintain open exchange markets. Iowa's down to one insurance company. And so I think we need to be honest about the Affordable Care Act is bankrupting America, and we need to take the hard look that when 60% of our old folks, of our senior citizens are on Medicaid, we're failing in some capacity. And that's, we can't point all the fingers at insurance and say, just give them money, because at some point money does run out.
Mm, okay. There's a few things I think people would take issue with what you were premising that on. But Nick, thank you very much for your perspective from Des Moines.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on, unless you had something to say, Dennis or Rachel, about that last caller. Let's talk about Monday's the Supreme Court clearing the way for Donald Trump to prohibit the entry of some people into the U.S. from countries he deems dangerous. The justices did impose those strict limits on the travel ban, the so-called travel ban. Actually, the president's called it that many times. Strict limits while they examine the scope of presidential power. Remember, this is something this U.S. Supreme Court has accepted. Now we'll hear arguments about presidential power. But in the meantime, this has happened. Trump has hailed the court's decision to hear arguments, calling it a clear victory for national security. How much of a victory is this for the president, what happened on Monday? To Dennis.
Well, in the first place, it reaffirms the power of the court to make that decision. Presidents have always raised the issue going back to Marbury versus Madison in 1803, that the court should stay out of this completely. And what the court did was say, yes, we've got the authority to make this determination of the extent of presidential power. It's a partial victory for Mr. Trump. Now, he tends not to be given to subtlety and nuance, right? Everything's like Obamacare is a disaster, or everything's beautiful and wonderful. This is sort of neither nor. It basically says that he can he's required to lift this ban with regard to people with some substantial connection to people or organizations, entities, as they put it, in the country already. But if somebody just sort of shows up on our doorstep and says, oh, gee, hi, I'd like to visit America, and I'm from that particular country, at least for the time being, that ban is still in force. We'll find out in the fall or whenever it's heard, unless it becomes moot by then, whether that would actually stay in force.
Mm-hmm. And so those challenging this travel ban are saying, here, with Monday's announcement by the Supreme Court, that it still protects the vast majority of people seeking to enter the U.S. As you pointed out, Dennis, if you're going to visit a relative here, it doesn't apply to you. If you're going to accept a job here, it doesn't apply to you. If you're going to attend a university or deliver a speech, these are all things that establish, I guess, a bona fide, what is the term here I'm reading, a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the U.S. That gets you through. That's a big doorway to walk through.
The big problem is, though, and I don't want to cut Rachel off here, is that at least it was brought up by Justices Gorsuch and Alito and Thomas as well, I believe. It puts the courts or somebody in the position of determining in any particular case, okay, do you have this connection? So that raises the prospect of even more complications in litigation.
Rachel, perhaps you can look forward to this, what has to be termed a historic legal clash. We're having the justices weigh the president's power to set some national securities priorities against the need for individuals to be protected from discrimination based on their origin of their country or their religious beliefs, right?
Yeah, and this is, as Dennis noted, Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch all kind of said this is an impractical halfway measure, and so they dissented. But, you know, so I think it's pretty clear that they would support allowing the full ban to go into effect. I think it's fair to say that we have at least four justices who would likely rule against the executive order as it's currently stated, and that would be Kagan and Breyer and Sotomayor and Ginsburg. So you really are going to see arguments now crafted for Justices Kennedy and Roberts.
Well, let me ask you this, Rachel, in your opinion, and Dennis can jump in here too, if not for the tweets, the way that the president launched this, did this, if we would have had a president who was, let's just say, more conventional and wouldn't have had tweets that are now being used against him in court.
And campaign rhetoric.
Would this have been a question that would have needed to go to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, in this case, the very consistent problem for the Trump administration has been that campaign rhetoric and those tweets from Donald Trump that seem to indicate the intent is, in fact, to ban Muslims from entering the country. He has really stayed firm on that language. Now, it's one of the things that's interesting is that after the court's decision this week, President Trump did not tweet. He released a statement from the White House. When he is conventional, we're all kind of shocked. It was a very conventional statement. And he called this, instead of calling it a ban, he called it a suspension, which is interesting as well. So perhaps inside the White House, they're realizing that, you know, the statements that have been made are a big part of the problem and why they're facing the doubt and skepticism that they have faced. It's formed a significant part of the legal battle so far. It is important to note as well that the court has said, you know, originally you said this was going to be a 90-day, 120-day review of procedures. And as Dennis noted, you know, they suggested, hey, maybe those 90 days you could review procedures. And potentially by October, this is a moot point and we won't even hear the case.
Mm-hmm. Travis is calling from Des Moines. I don't know. Does that answer your question, Travis? What question did you have about the travel ban?
I was just wondering how come the Supreme Court decided to reinstate parts of it instead of discussing whether and saying all of it or not
Okay.
In future time.
Yeah. Dennis, do you know the answer to Travis's question there?
Sometimes there's something, and it gets technical. Sometimes it's called severability. You can, if there's a statute at issue, and again, all this is not really, we're not deciding constitutionality here per se. It's just whether to uphold this travel ban or uphold the injunction against it until it's actually litigated in court. So we're really far before any of that happens. But there's sometimes a question if you call into question a particular piece of legislation or bill, does it take in it and it's bad? Does it take everything down with it, or does it take just the section but that leaves everything else standing? So that I think, is what gets to the issue here.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Rachel Caulfield, also of Drake, if you just joined us on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's talk about a wide-ranging international survey that was released on Monday by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center, a survey of 37 countries finding that favorable ratings of the U.S. have decreased from 64% of the people across these countries surveyed at the end of Barack Obama's presidency to 49% this spring. That's a 15% drop. New figures, so dropping to figures similar to those toward the end of the George W. Bush administration. The president himself in this poll has fared even worse. A median of 22% are confident that Donald Trump will do the right thing in global affairs, down from 64% who had confidence in Obama. 22% this president, 64% with confidence in the last president. So Donald Trump, of course, very active on the international front, withdrawal from the climate agreement, withdrawal of support from international trade agreements, travel ban, we just talked about that, withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement, the whole building the wall campaign promise. Dennis, how do you interpret these poll numbers? So such a drop.
Well, it's a drop, yes, indeed, but you have to remember, number one, the rest of the country seemed to have had a love affair, justified or not, with President Obama. This is part of the criticism of many people of him in this country, that he seemed to be more president, to want to be president of the world rather than president of the U.S. And Mr. Trump actually said at one point, I'm president of the United States, mm-hmm. not president of the world. So this has been part of the Republican critique of President Obama. But the rest of the world clearly had this love affair with the president, except in Russia. And a lot of that was actually Hillary Clinton's hard line that the president backed. And not as well in Israel because of President Obama's attempt to be more even-handed with the Arab countries with regard to the Palestinian situation. And so the survey, the Washington Post article, doesn't show particular pieces of it, but when I looked at it, I think it did one of these things. You take approvals and disapprovals, and you subtract disapproval from approval and see if you come out in negative or positive terms. And everybody was negative. In other words, there are more disapprovals than approvals of President Trump, or unfavorables rather than favorables, except in Russia and Israel. There was a slight margin on the positive side in Israel, and I think a larger margin for Russia, if I remember correctly. But the rest of the world, as much as they criticize the U.S., still looks toward the U.S. For leadership. And many of our erstwhile allies in Western Europe have the sense that, well, you talk terribly to us and you sweet talk our adversaries. What's going on?
Mm-hmm. Rachel, let me ask you this. Does this is just a poll. It is a poll. Mm-hmm. It does indicate something by a nonpartisan, well-respected research center, Pew Research. Does it translate into any problems for this administration, or is it just, as Dennis said, they didn't campaign to be elected president of the world? Donald Trump said, I'm going to be the president of the United States. So does this really translate to any problems that you can see?
Well, I don't think it translates into, like, electoral problems. You know, his base is very clear, and they don't need him to be popular in the rest of the world. I do think, however, that when you look at diplomacy, you look at how the United States is interacting with these countries around the world, there are a lot of common problems that countries come together to solve, including climate change, including the nuclear threat out of North Korea, including, you know, ISIS. So there's constant interaction and engagement with these countries. If sizable portions of the citizens of those countries don't trust U.S. leadership or don't trust Donald Trump and believe that he engages in international affairs with good faith, then it lessens any sort of domestic pressure that foreign leaders might feel to follow the lead of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it can weaken global standing of the United States pretty significantly.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up with this in the remaining 5 minutes that we have, Rachel and Dennis. On Sunday, the top Democrat in the House on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, we've been hearing a lot about him in the news. He said He believed the Obama administration should have taken bolder action in response to intelligence reports last year about Russia's efforts to influence the 2016 election. Here's Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat, on CNN's State of the Union.
I think the Obama administration should have done a lot more when it became clear that not only was Russia intervening, but it was being directed at the highest levels of the Kremlin. And indeed, Senator Feinstein and I were repeatedly trying to make that case to the administration initially when they didn't want to make attribution, they didn't want to publicly talk about Russia's role. And later, after we issued our own statement and they did attribute the conduct to Russia, I was urging that they begin then the process of sanctioning Russia, the administration talking more forcefully about what the Russians had done. I think that was a mistake, but I have to contest what President Trump is also saying, because for Donald Trump, who openly egged on the Russians to hack Hillary Clinton's emails and celebrated every release of these stolen documents to criticize Obama, now is a bit like someone knowingly receiving stolen property blaming the police for not stopping the theft. So Donald Trump is in no position to complain here.
Okay, that's Adam Schiff, the Democrat from California, top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee on CNN's State of the Union this past weekend. President Trump, to add to this, before I get comment from the both of you, President Trump seizing on the report from the Washington Post saying that President Obama knew as early as late August about the intelligence community's assessment that the Russians were directly involved in a cyber campaign to disrupt and discredit the election in an effort to help Trump win. Here is President Trump's tweet. Obama administration officials said they choked when it came to acting on Russian meddling of election. They didn't want to hurt Hillary? That was his tweet from Saturday. So a lot of information there. Quick comment from the both of you. Dennis Goldford, what do you think of Schiff's criticism of Barack Obama? Can we make that criticism now, nearly a year later?
The Obama administration was in a tough position because of, in a sense, damned if they did and damned if they didn't. If they had said anything directly or done anything, then there would have been criticism that they were interfering in the electoral process in Hillary Clinton's favor. On the other hand, not to do anything, as we seems to have been the case, also had an impact on the election itself. So they were caught in a difficult position. And I would just say real quickly, following Mr. Schiff, that in a way the Trump people want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to criticize President Obama for not taking action to deal with something that the Trump people say never occurred anyway.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, a comment?
Well, I think, you know, this is one of those hindsight is 2020 moments. I think the expectation on the part of the Obama administration wasn't so much that, you know, Hillary Clinton would be hurt, so they didn't want to move forward. They were, in other words, I don't think they were making a political decision to specifically advantage Hillary Clinton. Having said that, you know, the narrative of the campaign at the time focused very heavily on Donald Trump's very clear statements that the system was rigged. And so, you know, kind of buying into that narrative and creating more instability and insecurity and uncertainty about the electoral process was something that the Obama administration was hesitant to do. And I think that, you know, that's perfectly fair. You know, if you think about the context at the time, when we look back on it now, of course, Democrats are saying, wait a minute, if we knew this was happening, why are we only now really spending some time and effort to understand what happened and why? And it probably would have been helpful to be talking about this earlier. So, you know, I appreciate Adam Schiff actually stepping forward to make the critique, because I think, you know, I think Democrats have focused a lot of attention on Donald Trump and his associates, I think, to direct that same level of attention to what was going on in the Obama administration is important. Having said that, you know, however this was going to work out, there were going to be questions and and allegations and and problems, right?
Like,
it just so happened that the Obama administration made the choice that it did at the time, and now we have to kind of sort through the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute or so left. Dennis, let me go to you. And with what's happened this week, in the last few weeks, especially the collapse of the Senate plan for health care reform, what happens, how does this impact what's been happening lately to the rest of the GOP legislative agenda? Taxes, for instance, and other things that were planned.
The Republicans have been driven, as I said, number one, by the desire to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, to get rid of it. But they also, and in some ways their attempt to eliminate Obamacare as part of it, they also want to institute a tremendous tax reduction. And obviously, this this has gone on a lot. It takes up a lot of time, takes up a lot of energy. It's often hard for Congress to talk and chew gum at the same time. So it has clearly slowed down the Trump administration and the Republican leadership's agenda.
Okay. And we'll leave it for now. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. His colleague, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, associate professor of political science. Dennis and Rachel, great to have you as a duo on our airwaves for this last hour with all your insights. We appreciate it, you both.
Thanks so much, Ben.
All right. Tomorrow on this program, another reminder, Brooke Gladstone, my guest of On the Media. Perhaps you're a fan of that WNYC public radio program. She's co-host and managing editor of it. Talk with her tomorrow about her latest book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. She'll talk about fake news, alternative facts, and what she says are lies disguised as truths, all overwhelming our notions of reality. Talking about reality, the new reality, with Brooke Gladstone tomorrow on this program. I hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for being here.